Lessons Drawn from a Sinner, an exposition of Genesis chapter 9, verses 18 through 29. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, July the 25th, 2012.
The sports world was rocked this week as they finally handed down the ruling on Penn State and the sanctions connected with that. This whole scandal has been devastating on everybody involved. When legends die, it's hard to accept. And when you think of what's happened just in a matter of a few months, it's incredible. In November, this thing first started coming out, and now we have the free report, the trial's over, Sandusky's been sentenced, and all of that. And then this week, Joe Paterno's statue is removed from the front of the stadium. And the next day, the wall that was behind it is completely removed. Every plaque that had his name on it, everything connected with him, has been completely removed from the stadium and from the campus. And he went from the winningest coach in college football history to number 12 on the list, because they took away 111 victories over the last 10 years. Legends die hard. And when they do, we don't want to accept it. I mean, honestly, would you prefer to think of Bud Wilkinson as the great coach of the Oklahoma Sooners or as the hapless coach of the St. Louis Cardinals? I mean, we want to remember him as a winning coach in the great program instead of that struggle and that fiasco when he tried to coach professional football. We like to remember Ted Williams at his last time at the plate in Fenway hit a home run. That's how we want to see our heroes go out, not go out with some kind of scandal or not go out with some kind of tragic thing connected to them. We don't like to see our heroes tarnished. That's what makes the text that we're looking at this evening so difficult. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 9 says, Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Following the flood, we read, Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings to the Lord. See, when we read that, then we say, well, no wonder Peter describes him as a preacher of righteousness. No wonder we find him in Hebrews chapter 11 as one of the great heroes of the faith. That's what makes it difficult when we read in Genesis chapter 9, Noah proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and he lay uncovered inside his tent. Now I read that and I say, what in the world? What happened? What are you thinking? You can't help but be disappointed. But even from this great disappointment, we learn some valuable lessons. We're going to look at Genesis chapter 9, verse 18 down to verse 29. Paul tells us in Corinthians that the Old Testament is written for our benefit. In writing to those first century saints, he said, the Old Testament scriptures are there for you to learn from. They're not just stories about the past. You are to read that and learn where they failed. You are to see where they succeeded. You are to learn from their example so you don't repeat their failures and so that you can learn from their success. The purpose is to teach us lessons about walking in faith and obedience. We are to learn from the past. As we look at the book of Genesis, we learn a lot from the opening chapters. We discover who's responsible for this world. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it's made clear that God is responsible for all of creation. We discover His great power. We find that He created with a purpose. There was a reason behind what He did, and man was created to be in the image and likeness of God in order to relate to Him and to be in relationship with Him. And we are created with the capacity of being able to communicate with God, understand God, and commune with Him. We find that God is serious about sin and holiness. He is just. He's also loving. He is just, he is merciful, he is kind, he is gracious, and he is full of wrath. Grace and law are both part of his character. In chapter 3, we learn how we got in the mess we're in. God had created and everything was good. At the end of every day of creation, God said, that's good, until they got to the last, the sixth day, and he said, that's very good. As Adam and Eve are created in his image and likeness, and as they're placed in the garden at the crowning moment of the creative act, he said, that is very good. And then he rested, and it was a beautiful and wonderful creation. But in chapter 3, something went horribly wrong, and it affected all of creation. Not just Adam and Eve, but all of us who follow, all of us who are the sons and daughters of Adam, fall into sin and are tainted by sin and have to deal with that. But not just us, the whole of creation. Paul reminds us in Romans that all of creation is groaning, waiting the redemption. So all of creation has been affected by the fall. Yet we discover grace even in the announcement of judgment, because even though God brought judgment on man because of his sin, he also promised a redeemer back in Genesis chapter 3. He's patient, he's gracious, and even in the judgment of the flood, when he's sorry he ever made man, in grace he spared Noah and his family. The description of Noah is not the reason for his receiving the grace of God, but the evidence that he did receive the grace of God. Now, this section in Genesis 9 is troubling, to say the least. How did it happen? How could it come to this? Noah, what are you thinking? And what is all this about Ham and a curse and all of that? I mean, what are we going to learn from this soap opera? Let's look beginning in chapter 9 and verse 18. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the vine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent, and Ham, the father of Cain, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both of their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah woke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years, and the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. We read that and we say, "Well, that's great. What are we supposed to learn from that? I mean, what lessons do we learn from a soap opera? I mean, that sounds like something we'd watch on reality TV. What do we learn from this passage? I think we learn that by Noah's fall, we are reminded of the power and the devastation of sin. Noah is an example for us. He is a picture, a model, to remind us in very vivid terms of the power and the devastation of sin. Again, the biblical narrator tells the story, and there are many parallels between the creation account and the account of Noah and the flood. There is again the command to be fruitful and fill the land. There is the pronouncement that the animal world will be in submission to man. Adam and Eve were placed in a garden. Now Noah plants a garden. Adam sinned, and it was devastating to his family. Noah sins and wreaks havoc on his descendants. Three things I want to point out from this text. First, in verse 18 through verse 21, we are reminded none of us are immune to sin. None of us are immune. And it's really important that we acknowledge that, because sometimes we think we are. We would never say that we are, but our attitude, and in particular, our attitude toward other sinners, indicates that we really think somehow we are immune, that we would never fall into the sin that they fell into. If you and I were to produce a list of sins, If I sit down and wrote out my list as a sin as I understood it, you write out your list, we would have some overlapping sins that we would both put down as sin. But all of our lists would be different. And the interesting thing about it would be to compare where we differ. And you would look at things on my list and say, how come this isn't on your list? And my answer, if I'm honest, would be, because I got a problem with that and I don't want to list that as a sin. I remember hearing a preacher when I was in seminary, and he was talking about our struggle with sin. And he said, you know, when you find a preacher who rails against particular sins, it's usually caused by one of two things. Either, number one, he has never been tempted in that area, so he has no understanding of someone struggling with it. And so he gets up and thunders and rails against it. Or he struggles with that every day of his life, and it's a way of trying to keep himself in line. And the more I've thought about it, that's exactly right. If we're not careful, we'll think we are immune to certain temptations and certain sins. But the bottom line is, when you and I really understand what it means to be fallen, and we really understand the depth of the wickedness of our own heart, then we'll have to acknowledge there is nothing I wouldn't do but for the grace of God. Nothing. If the circumstances are just right, there's nothing I wouldn't do left to myself. Now that's the safest thing for you in dealing with sin, is for you to come to the point to acknowledge that. To lose your arrogance so that you understand I can't trust my own strength in any area. I must rely on the Lord. I must seek His power. None of us are immune. None of us are above or beyond temptation in any area. Look at what happened to this righteous man. He was a righteous man. And his righteousness is reflected in the fact that he preached righteousness and he obeyed the command of God, and he did that because God said certain things were going to happen and he took God at His word. How difficult do you think it was for him to stand and preach all those years about a flood coming and everybody looked around and said, there's not a cloud in the sky? And the mocking and the ridicule. He was a righteous man, but what happened to him? Now, the interesting thing this week, as I looked through this passage and as I did some reading, were the number of commentators who wanted to make excuses for Noah. It was comical to me how many of them wanted to say it really wasn't his fault. One of them wrote that he really was not aware of what wine could do. As if there was no wine before the flood. I mean, that's really stretching it to try to say that. In fact, the phrase that says that Noah drank, he planted a vineyard and he drank of the wine and became drunk, the word actually means Noah drank deep. In other words, to use a more common expression, he was slamming it down. This was not his first taste of the fruit of the vine. Noah was a righteous man. He was a blameless man before the people of his time. But Noah was not without sin. Noah was a man of flesh and bone. And Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5 and chapter 8 and verse 21 that talks about the wickedness of the heart, it's only evil all the time, applied to Noah the same as it did everyone else. Noah was accepted in the sight of God by God's grace, not by his performance. And so we need to understand what we see happening to Noah in this passage is the natural consequence of his fallenness. By the way, this is another example of the inspiration of Scripture. If you were writing a book to try to use it in a way to bolster your faith, would you tar your heroes like this? No. It's an honest representation of what happened and the kinds of people that God loves and is in relationship with. Noah is a vivid reminder of Romans 3 and verse 23. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. When did Noah fall? When did this failure come into his life? Well, he was 600 years old. So what does that tell us? It tells us that our past success does not provide power for future victory. You're never going to get to the point in this life where you have reached a place where you're no longer prone to temptation. Care how old you get, how long you've been around, how faithful you've been, we are not holy. We are declared holy in the sight of God because of Christ. We are in the process of being made holy as we walk in obedience before Him. And we are growing in holiness, but we're not there yet. And we won't be until we're transformed at the coming of Christ or our entering His presence when death comes. As long as we live here, we will be stumbling toward holiness, and we are prone to sin. Our only defense is the grace of God. Lesson number one from this sinner: no one is immune from sin. Second, verses 22 and 23. Our sin can serve as the occasion of another's sin. Our sin can serve as the occasion of another's sin. Noah's sin led to the sin of his son Ham. Now, when we read about Ham and what he did, again, sometimes commentaries are helpful, and sometimes they're not helpful at all. I've read some very interesting interpretations of what his sin actually was, and I have to say, some of what they said I wouldn't like to tell in mixed company. I don't think there's any reason to read into the text any more than what it actually says. I mean, I read all kinds of things about homosexual perversion and all kinds of stuff. You've got to read that into the text. The text is pretty straightforward. He saw his father's nakedness, and he went and talked about it to his brothers. Implied in that is he mocked, laughed, and ridiculed his father. That was his sin. His youngest son saw his father's nakedness, and he immediately went and told his brothers. His brothers took a blanket, walked backwards, and placed it over their father so that they would not see. Now, what is the sin? First of all, I don't think it was an accident that he saw his father's nakedness. I don't think he happened upon it. I think he was looking for something. I think he was seeking to find fault with his father. His sin was in his reaction to his discovery. He reveled in the failure of his father, and he joyfully shared that failure with others. In doing so, he greatly dishonored his father. Most likely, he made fun of his father's drunkenness and his nakedness, and there was no sense of shame in any of it. Maybe, and I'm acknowledging and I'm admitting up front, I'm speculating. Maybe it was his way to speak out against his father's preaching and his father's God. He wouldn't be the first preacher's kid to do it. Maybe he felt neglected. Maybe he didn't agree. Maybe he wasn't walking with God, and he felt guilty, so the way to feel better about himself was to pull his father down. I think that's what's going on. And I think there's a warning in this for us. When you and I come upon another's sin, our reaction ought not to be one of reveling. It ought not to be one of rejoicing and mocking. It ought to be one of regret. It ought to be a response of remorse and sorrow because of the devastation of sin, particularly in the life of another believer. You know, I started by talking about how we don't like to see our heroes fall, but there's another side to that where we really do like to see them fall. How else do you explain the numbers of people who rejoice when a prominent believer falls? There are those who pounce on that. And it's not just those godless people out there. Some of the people who pounce on it are those within the church. Because it seems like we revel in finding the hypocrisy in each other. Part of the sin of Ham is his reveling in the sin and the fall of his father. Overjoyed that his godly father was no better than the pagans destroyed in the flood. Whatever the occasion, Noah's sin served as the occasion for the sin of Ham. Another point that we need to understand is we do not sin in isolation. We're a body. The whole imagery that Paul paints for us in 1 Corinthians 12 ought to make it clear to us that we never sin in isolation as a believer. My sin affects you, and your sin affects me. And when one part of the body hurts, the whole body hurts. That's why there's no reason for rejoicing in sin, in anyone's sin. Our sin affects others. Our example can wreak havoc in the lives of others. That's why parents and leaders have to be constantly reminded to be on their guard. Beware lest you cause another to stumble. We are not immune to sin, and our sin may very well serve as the occasion of another person's sin. Third and last, verse 24, down to the end of the chapter. Sin carries devastating consequences. This is probably the most difficult question in the passage. Why did God curse Cain when it was Ham who sinned? It's the biblical principle that the sins of the fathers will be visited on the children and the children's children, in that they are more than likely going to repeat the sins that they saw modeled and set before them. In the punishment, Ham is reaping what he sowed. He sinned as a son, and he is punished through his own son. But at the same time, it is God's grace in operation, because not every descendant of Ham was cursed. He had four children. One of them was cursed. So it's not a blanket cursing of all of his descendants. One other thing. Let's forever dispense with the myth that this is where black people come from. That was a popular teaching, never thought of, never dreamed of in the history of the church until the middle of the 19th century. I wonder why. Because it was used to justify slavery in the United States. Well, that's where black people came from. They're all descended of Ham. And God said they're cursed and they'll be the servants of others. So there's nothing wrong with slavery. I mean, that's wrong on so many levels. Not the least of which is there's no biblical justification for it. But there's not just cursing. There's also blessing. Shem and Japheth are blessed. Blessed by the Lord, the God of Shem. Verse 26. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. It's actually a continuation from Genesis 3 and verse 15. Messiah would come through the godly line of Seth. Now we find that it's going to come through Shem. Later it'll come through the house of David. So again, even in the curse, there is the note of blessing. Even in the cursing, there is grace and there is mercy. None of us are immune. And my sin affects others. And the consequences of sin are devastating. This is why we are to be on guard. This is why we are to scope ourselves. Remember Paul's talking to the Galatians and he said, what do you do when you come upon one who's caught in sin? He said, you better seek to restore him in a spirit of gentleness, scoping yourself lest you too fall into sin. Now it's interesting. He didn't say, ignore it and you're not to judge them, so you just deal with yourself. That isn't what he said. He said, you need to restore them. And the word he used is a medical term. And the word he used is the same word that was used in the first century when someone broke an arm and they had to set it. That means put it back the way it's supposed to be. So what do you do when you come upon your brother who's caught in sin? You correct. But how do you correct? In a spirit of gentleness. Now, does that mean there's no pain involved? I don't know if you've ever had a bone set. There's pain involved. You know, Riordan taught me this. Not pain, but the principle. She said, it's never a good thing when you're in the hospital and they say, take a deep breath. It's going to hurt, whatever it is you're getting ready to do. To restore will often be painful, but necessary. We are to go about it in a spirit of gentleness. And how do we go about it in a spirit of gentleness? Looking to yourself. The word means scoping. Lest you too fall. In other words, when I see my brother in sin, my response is to lovingly go to them, to seek to restore them, put them back where they're supposed to be, as lovingly as I can, understanding how vulnerable I am to the same problem. It's what we're called to. Not ignoring it, because I don't serve my brother by ignoring his sin. I'm not helping when I say there's nothing here. Need to acknowledge it. And need to call them to deal with it. And need to come alongside them in dealing with it. But not as their judge, but as a fellow sinner. Fully aware of my own faults and my own failings. As we struggle together to live the life that he's called us to. We're not immune. And our actions affect others, not just our children and our family, but the people of the community, the people that see us. And the effects are devastating. So, be on guard. Be aware of the power and the devastating consequences of our sin.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.